Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The wheels of justice hit some speed bumps in March when COVID-19 slowed court business to all but the highest priorities, and many judges pivoted, when possible, to virtual proceedings. Even the Supreme Court in April embraced a new normal, holding its first ever oral arguments by teleconference. In Texas, more than two dozen potential jurors recently logged in by smartphone, laptop, and tablet for remote jury selection, which streamed on YouTube. Ohio's High Court also is adapting, awarding $6 million in technology grants to help local courts do the same. Chief Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court, Maureen O'Connor, joins us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Great to be here.
What's the balance that you're looking to strike during this time with technology, allowing courts to continue to operate in some cases, but it's not quite business as usual either?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part of your question.
It's not exactly business as usual either. So I'm wondering, like, what's the balance you're trying to strike right now?
What we're trying to do is give courts capacity in order to ramp up their use of technology so that they are going to be able to expand their services to the public. And that was the intent of this grant program that you referenced, the $6 million. And that was directed to about 270 courts in the state. 87 out of 88 counties received those dollars, and they were those dollars went to ramping up capacity so that there's a ability to provide the services to individuals without the need to have face-to-face contact. So that's the goal here initially, given the environment that we have with the directives from the health department and the governor. As things get, I guess, change, I'm not going to say get back to normal, because we're never going to get back to normal,
right.
I think. But if there is a silver lining to this from the court's point of view, and remember, we're a service industry. We're there to provide services for people. And if we can make the services more readily available, more convenient, more effective, more nimble, more flexible, and we can do that through technology, then that's our end game here with the use of technology.
Whenever I talk about technology in this way, there's always the haves and the have-nots still in our society. What about that problem?
That is a problem. You're right. We have found, though, and other jurisdictions have found the same thing, that the use of technology, and just let me give you some basic examples of it, of how it works and how it has worked effectively. Notifying people of their court dates is a perfect example. It seems like everybody has a cell phone, the ability to communicate through cell phones. And sending text messages, sending, you know, reminders, for example, of your court date to appear in court, reminder of your probation, reporting, et cetera. The numbers of non-appearances have lowered dramatically across the country as a result of the use of that technology. So it doesn't have to be sophisticated. When we talk about technology, you mentioned in your intro that there was a jury trial of sorts that was accomplished in Texas, and that's a great example of the use of technology. But we can use it for much more basic communications as well, to the advantage of the people who are dealing with the courts. I'm always preaching this message when people say, "Well, we're going to open up." The retail operations are going to open up restaurants, et cetera, and those are places that people go by choice,
mm-hmm.
And they have an opportunity to either go or not go, or go on their own terms. That's not the same as the courts. People don't go to court usually voluntarily. You have to be summoned into court. You're summoned for jury duty. You're ordered to come to court, and that's why I think the courts have a more of a responsibility, a bigger responsibility, to make sure that we're using technology and we're also adhering to the directives of the Department of Health, so that when people do come into the court, when they come into the courthouse, the courtroom, they feel safe, they have confidence in our system, and they have confidence in the judge that that they're interacting with, or the magistrate.
If you have a question or comment for Chief Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court, Maureen O'Connor, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We are talking about how the courts are using technology to deal with the challenges of the pandemic, social distancing, that kind of a thing. What kind of feedback are you hearing from lawyers and court personnel about this? Is there something that's really working in some places but not so well in others?
We actually have gotten great feedback, feedback from the courts on how they're able to adapt, how they're able to use that technology and supplement what they had already. For example, mobile video conferencing, one of the things that Cuyahoga County Juvenile Court's doing is to expand their capacity because they use the money that they received to get two mobile video conferencing carts with laptops to create a, you know, virtual courtrooms for, you know, their hearings with the juveniles. They're not the only ones that have used that technology. You know, in Summit County, doing the same thing. The use of the audio equipment, the use of just, you know, as I said, there's 277 courts that benefited from these dollars. And some benefited, you know, a few thousand dollars because that's what they requested, and some were over $100,000, depending on what their capacity was and what their need was. So, yeah, it is a success. I hear that all the time. And it's a success with the lawyers as well. They are just as concerned as any other group about their health, about the health of their loved ones, and appearing in a venue when they don't have to.
There are some counties in Ohio, though, that have a big problem with access to internet. Even if there are hotspots they can go to, they have to travel many miles. It's an ongoing haves and have not situation. Have you heard from those counties about how that's working for them?
I haven't received any indications that it's not working for them. Your point is well taken. There are communities that are behind the curve when it comes to their internet capacity, and that is a problem that has to be addressed. And as we transition, the entire state has to ramp up with those kinds of capacities, because I think this remote virtual whatever you want to call it, is what's going to happen in the future, not only for government services. You know, you look at the medical community and how they responded, telemedicine. Before this even occurred, the medical community was doing telemedicine. The courts were implementing a teletreatment for drug court and other specialty docket capacities. So this is not something that was just out of the clear blue, and we, you know, responded simultaneously or instantaneously with this. We had a pretty good technology backbone in the court system to begin with. You know, we've been giving out tech grants to the courts for the last 6 years, giving out over $17 million to the courts, over 800 grants. So when this hit, and the need for ramping up, some other capacities within the court, we already had a system in place, a template to use, and we were able to get this money out to the courts for them to purchase the what they needed remarkably fast. And I'm talking within days.
Let's see, Deborah in Fairfield County, you're on the air with the Chief Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court, Maureen O'Connor. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. It's not true that people all have cell phones and some people don't have anything except a landline phone and a radio. There's a lot of people who don't have computers or cell phones, and they don't have money to buy them or people to show them how to run them, and their cases have been completely forgotten, and that there's crooked lawyers who tell them that their case isn't worth their time, and they just work with the magistrates to take people's money.
Okay, well, Deborah, that's a different topic, but Deborah's making a salient point. There could be some people that fall through the cracks in all of this, Chief.
And yes, let me address that. And I understand, you know, definitely hear what she is saying about the lack of a cell phone or a computer, but she has a telephone. And telephone conferencing is another method, you know, of technology to be utilized that wasn't necessarily utilized in the past. Look at the United States Supreme Court. They're teleconferencing their oral arguments, and that's changed the format of their, how they do business as well. So I don't mean that people have to have terribly sophisticated equipment in order to interact with the court. Far from it. Telephones and conferencing on telephones works just as well as a Zoom if that's what you've got to work with.
Deborah, thanks a lot for that call. Where do you see courts are also moving to digitize paper records, could speed up searches. What about that? Chief Justice,
electronic filing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're talking about electronic filing, I think, Ann.
Okay.
And that's another area. In fact, when I talked about that $17 million in grants that were given out over the last 6 years, many grants were for their case management systems to make them more efficient, to bring them, you know, up to date, the ability to incorporate. E-filing is extremely important and a big component of that. We have e-filing at the Supreme Court. Now, it's not an easy thing to do, and it's not an inexpensive thing to do, but that is what the wave of the future is for courts, is to implement e-filing. You know, one thing that I think is important to note here is that we have 88 counties, which means 88 different county court systems, and we're not a unified system in Ohio. Each court has its own budget, and oftentimes that is a reflection of the ability of the county commissioners and the resources that are available. So I guess my message is, unfortunately, not all courts are created equal. Which is another reason why I instituted this tech grant program, not only for the COVID-19 crisis, but for the last 6 years.
Well, Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thanks for the interest.
You bet. Maureen O'Connor, Chief Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court, which, as she just mentioned, has been awarding grants, most recently about $6 million in technology grants to help local courts adapt to changing times by way of the coronavirus. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The battle still rages over whether and how to police, or how much to police, what content Facebook, Google, and other big tech companies share on their platforms. As the coronavirus put hundreds of news outlets out of business around the world in April, Australia, followed by France, took steps to make Facebook and Google pay up. New York Times media columnist Ben Smith has been covering the issue. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So France and Australia want to force these tech titans to pay for content from newspapers that have been shared on their platforms. What have been the arguments against doing this in the past?
Well, you know, the argument about it is mostly this just isn't the way the internet works. You know, you're used to being able to go on Facebook, being able to go on Google and search for something and see whatever you want. And the tradition in Google and Facebook have always considered themselves to be doing like news organizations a favor by linking to, you know, your podcast or something, by allowing people to find your stuff on them. And have given, you know, many news organizations bigger audiences than they could ever have imagined. The only problem is there's been very, very little money that comes with that.
Right. Anybody can watch it or look at it. No one has to pay for it. What's different this time around?
Well, I think, you know, the news industry is in such dire straits and really accelerated by this pandemic. The advertising business is collapsing. And meanwhile, Google and Facebook are really thriving on that advertising business. So I think particularly in countries where the government tends to take a heavier hand in these sort of industrial disputes, I think you see the Australian and French governments basically saying all this advertising revenue shifted from publishers to the platforms, and we're just going to kind of put our thumbs on the scale and push it back.
You know, whenever I talk about this topic with someone like you, Ben Smith, the third or fourth question always is, well, what about the United States? It's taken a more hands-off approach to regulating tech companies over the decades. What about that philosophy, and how might that be impacted by these efforts in Australia and France?
You know, I think that the reason people are looking particularly to Australia so closely right now is that there's an assumption that whatever happens there will become the universal rule. I think the U.S. is unlikely to regulate them exactly, but they are already feeling a lot of heat. There's also, you know, some publishers use the power of the press just to beat them up. Like I think News Corp in particular, if you turn on Fox News, you're going to see people talking about how terrible Google is. And maybe that's what they think, or maybe it's in the context of a commercial dispute. But I think that a lot of the tech companies perceive that as a form of political pressure.
Right. I mean, News Corp is a big difference this time around at this point.
Yeah.
It's huge. In 2014, Google tried to outmaneuver Spain when regulators wanted compensation for news content. Then what happened there?
So this is really interesting. Basically, in Spain, the Spanish said, you know, if you're going to use headlines from newspapers on Google News to pay the newspapers, since they did the work of, you know, finding the news and writing the headline, Google said, okay, forget it. We'll shut down Google News and just shut it down and left Spain. In France, the regulators more or less said the same thing, said, you know, you have to negotiate with publishers to pay them money to use these lines. Google said, okay, we're going to negotiate. The price we offer you is zero. Either take it or we'll throw you off the platform. And what happened then in France is that competition.
Ben, we're losing you. Hey, could you repeat that again, Ben? We just lost you.
Yeah. So what happened in France is that the competition regulator stepped in and said, what you're doing here is anti-competitive. We're going to forbid you from leaving France. You have to keep this, and you have to negotiate with publishers. And so they're suddenly in a bit of a box in France.
They are taking different approaches, Facebook and Google are, to this more aggressive regulatory posture in these countries. What's the difference between the two companies?
Well, Facebook, which got beat up so badly here after the 2016 election, I think is trying to play nice. It has a program in the United States where it's paying a number of publishers, including the New York Times, for the right to use their content on its new news platform, news tab. Google, meanwhile, is saying, absolutely not, we'll never pay a dime, it's a matter of principle, which is playing really, really in Europe.
With the money that Facebook's now paying, will that really make a difference to the likes of New York Times, let alone all the other platforms or other news companies?
The amount Facebook is paying are meaningful for the publishers who are getting it, I think, who are mostly the big publishers. You know, it's not going to revolutionize the business, but it's not trivial. It's millions of dollars. I think the question is, you know, in a way, like, the biggest publishers can make deals with these big platforms that help that will help stabilize their businesses. I think for smaller local players, it's like there's nothing here, and that's really where the deepest crisis is, you know, places like the Plain Dealer. And And it's not clear to me how they get helped by this at all.
Well, one of the problems these days is that there are no smaller local players. They're all owned by gigantic conglomerates or chains. I mean, they could bring some weight to bear, couldn't they?
Yeah, that's right. And I do think that the chains are starting to try to negotiate as a group with the platforms. And you know what? There's a world where that could help these local. I think, you know, honestly, I think that this is in something where you're more likely to see the biggest national players get stronger than something that is going to help the local news.
Negotiations. Well, by the way, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday. I'm talking with the New York Times media columnist Ben Smith about efforts in Australia and France to make Facebook, Google, and other big tech companies pay for the content from news organizations that they share on their platforms. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So negotiations are underway now between Google and publishers, I guess newspaper or news publishers. What do we know about that?
Well, you know, not a lot. The Australians are basically going to put out a set of rules for those negotiations this summer. I think Google still hopes that they'll be able to talk them out of making them pay anything. But the regulator's point of view is that, look, if there were seven search engines, you know, if Google was just one of seven search engines and they all wanted to use news content, they'd be negotiating with publishers about how much to pay to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And that because Google's basically a monopoly, the government wants to kind of like simulate that market to say like, well, what would they be paying if it was a real marketplace? And it's a pretty aggressive sort of point of view. And you know, I think one of the sort of big picture things that's happening is that these big global tech companies for a long time would just act like they were governments and ignore national governments. Then you started to see stuff happen. Like in Brazil, they would, you know, WhatsApp or YouTube would have a local judge in Brazil say, you got to take this down, and they would ignore it. Say, what is this, some ridiculous local judge in Brazil? And then the Brazilian police would raid their headquarters and arrest all their executives. And they started to realize like, oh, these national governments have real power. And I think you're starting to see that. But like, I mean, it hasn't been a big story in the U.S., but inside these companies, they're spending a lot of time and they're very focused on what's happening in Australia. They're on conference calls that, you know, start at 6 p.m. and go till midnight because that's the time zone. It's pretty interesting.
Give me a sense about where the U.S. ranks in all of this. Is it the big kahuna? I mean, if they had to start playing by these kinds of rules in the U.S., would that be a huge game changer?
No, I don't think so. I think the U.S. will wind up following behind. I think that, like, as with a lot of these internet regulations, the U.S. is laissez-faire, but other governments are doing stuff that does probably represent kind of the will of the people and the popular opinion. Things like the right to be forgotten, where if you have something really embarrassing on Google, you can basically in Europe get it taken down. I think that you're starting to see that stuff spread to the U.S. from Europe and from Asia and from elsewhere. I think to the U.S. basically just kind of lagging.
Like it does in everything when it comes to this kind of stuff. But you wrote that the power of the press, and we were talking about it a second ago regarding News Corp, is formidable and that lawmakers are sensitive to that. Is that lawmakers in France and Australia and not necessarily the U.S.?
Oh, no. Lawmakers in the U.S. love to have newspaper publishers like them, right? I mean, it's
yes.
Not, I think it's something you certainly see. That's something you see locally. And I think there are other ways in which the U.S. has traditionally subsidized media. There are legal notices. If you open a newspaper, there are pages and pages of small type that businesses are required to publish, which makes no sense, but is a very important source of revenue for newspapers. And so that's a law that's imposed. Newspapers have received subsidies in postal distribution.
Yep.
The press has since like the founding of the Republic. And I do think there are efforts here and there to try to figure out locally how you could, you know, treat news as a public good and support it. But, you know, that you get very quickly into a place where the government is telling you what to write and where publishers are scared to, you know, annoy government officials who pay their bills. And I think that's obviously really dangerous, too.
Yeah, we were talking about the postal system last week and how, you know, you're right, the founding fathers thought that it was, they wouldn't have used the word, but it was sort of the internet of its day. It's what got news around.
Yeah, that's right. And it was on purpose, and they mm-hmm. it was very cheap to distribute news.
There are also efforts to force big tech to rapidly, as within an hour, I read, remove posts that contain hate speech. In France, the hate speech law passed last week and it was a signature issue for the president there. How did this become a priority particularly?
You know, I mean, I think it's something that we all see on platforms. And in the U.S., we all say, you know, this is kind of the price of freedom is having some really obnoxious speech. And in Europe, they say, this is outrageous, take it down or go to jail. I mean, there's a different approach to hate speech.
And how are the tech companies responding?
You know, they're fighting it. They're saying it's basically impractical. It's the same thing they say about paying publishers. I think, you know, the problem, their business models are built on not having to employ very many people, on having massive, massive scale, then having algorithms work. And things like this, where, oh, gosh, we're going to have to hire thousands more content moderators, become very expensive for them. That's why they don't like it. But, I mean, they've already kind of conceded this. I mean, I think there's something like 35,000 people working, 25,000 people around the world working as content moderators for Facebook and for Google. And, you know, that's almost, I mean, if you look at the number of professional content moderators, the line is just going up and up as the number of journalists goes down and down. It's pretty depressing.
Yeah, that's a sad contrast in statistics. The opposition party in France, I guess that would be the right-wing opposition party, said that the move would result in preemptive censorship. What's the basis for that?
Well, I think that they are saying that they would basically use algorithms to, you know, you would post something that used key hateful words and it just would never appear. And that appeared, you would post it and you would think it had posted and just no one would see it. Of course, you could be commenting. You could be writing an article about the N-word and why it was pernicious and that wouldn't show up. You could be making an in-joke with members of your community of using an ethnic slur and that would never show up. And so I think it does not seem, the idea that these kind of very blunt algorithms are going to moderate people's speech seems like that will obviously not work that well.
Okay. Well, Ben Smith, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
It's Ben Smith. He's a media columnist for The New York Times. We've been talking about how some countries, particularly France and Australia, are talking about what kind of content Facebook, Google, and other big tech companies can share on their platforms without paying the piper. That is the creators of the content. So we have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Microsoft announced this week that sales of Minecraft have surpassed 200 million copies, making it the best-selling game of all time, just as a new update is ready for launch. Minecraft Dungeons will be available May 26, a little later than expected because of the pandemic. Russell Holly is a contributing editor at Android Central. Welcome back, Russell.
Hi.
Are you excited?
About Minecraft?
Yeah.
Not especially.
Okay.
but there are clearly lots and lots of other people who are, which is why I like to talk about it. I have people on my team who are very excited about Minecraft. It's just not one of those games that I was ever really able to get into.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is about my brain that just, you know, I doesn't see, like, you know, kid-friendly Legos for adults and just doesn't get super excited. It seems like it would be extremely my thing, but I just, every time I've sat down to play it, I just can't get into it. 20 million other people have...
200!
200 million other people. Yeah, they're clearly way more people. This is one of the most popular games of all time, and it just continues to grow in popularity. It's one of those things that just kind of sits in the background. People who play games, that like they only play the game that just came out that week, and they play it and they move on to the next thing.
Uh-huh.
They probably don't think about a game like Minecraft too much. But there are people who just build these massive worlds. They spend months and months and months building, and then they share with other people. And they just keep doing that for a really long time. And it encourages so many more people to go in and do the same thing.
The only time I ever played it was when I did it was a coding tutorial.
I think I was the one who sent you that.
I think you probably were, and it was interesting, but I tried to figure out, I guess I'm just slow, but I thought, man, this could take years to build a wall.
That's right, yeah. No, it's true, and what's really funny is that you and I would go through and reach that same conclusion where it's like, wow, you know, just building this one simple structure would take a long time. And then there are these just incredibly engineer brain people who look at that and go, actually, there's tools in here for me to automate a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
And I've watched people go through and build these incredible machines inside of Minecraft where the whole purpose of the machine is to make those bricks to make building the wall easier. So they now spent 20 more hours to make that one task that much easier. And it's just fascinating to see people work inside of this platform.
Do you think that it proliferates and that it encourages people in an effort to train an entire generation of children how to fight aliens?
No, I think it goes back to something a little similar, to a little simpler. This is kind of the building blocks of problem solving for a lot of people, you know, because there's so many different ways to solve a particular problem inside of Minecraft. You need to build a house to keep yourself from being attacked by, you know, some kind of night monster. And everybody, you know, when the lights are out and you're young, everyone fears the night monster in the middle of nowhere. Well, this is actually a thing in this game. So you have to build yourself a shelter to protect yourself from that. And there are so many different ways to solve that problem. And I think that's like the biggest strength to Minecraft is that it has just all of these incredible ways that you can solve problems. And that's probably why I'm not very good at it. Because I'm not very good at solving problems.
I doubt that.
So I think that's what it ultimately comes down to, though, is that this is an excellent problem-solving tool for people to kind of, you know, stretch their brain a little bit.
One reviewer called Minecraft Dungeons a total rethink of the tried and tested Minecraft formula, which sounds risky.
It is. You know, the whole point of Dungeons is that it takes you kind of out of the sandbox where you can kind of create whatever you want and do whatever you want, and introduces more of what we would consider the standard game model, you know, where you're going through some preset missions in order to do some things and solve some puzzles and fight some monsters. And while Minecraft has always had elements of this throughout the game, it's always been kind of freewheeling. It's been, you know, kind of a choose your own adventure kind of thing, whereas Dungeons is very much, you know, someone at Microsoft has built this puzzle for you to solve. And so it is very different from the way Minecraft has run up until this point. But I think Microsoft has done a tremendous amount of user research and found that there's a desire for this for at least a large enough set of people playing the game that it's worth having this expansion and giving these people more reasons to keep playing.
It said that it came out it's a little later than expected because of the pandemic. How did that affect things? Just supply?
Yeah, so what we found with a lot of different developer groups is that, you know, it took a little bit of time to kind of relearn how to build things in a remote way. You know, so Microsoft in particular, they're very, very good at having people in teams and buildings and kind of working collaboratively on things, having these kind of projects that go across, you know, large scale. But it very much relies on having people physically in an office in order to do that, you know, remote work. It's certainly something you can do at Microsoft, but you're much more effective inside of these kind of individual facilities. And so, you know, you're going to naturally slow down at first when you're sent home and that environment goes away. But it's also, you know, something at the scale of Microsoft can kind of quickly pick that back up. So the delay wasn't huge, but it was definitely noticeable.
The game's developer, Mojang, is that how I pronounce that right?
Mojang, yeah, was the name of the producing, you know, kind of team that was bought by Microsoft a couple of years ago.
Okay. And was that the team that originally developed Minecraft?
There are still some people who were on the original Minecraft team still at Mojang, but it is not predominantly staffed by those people anymore.
Okay. And now it's been rebranded as Mojang Studios and merged two studios. What's the significance of that? Anything?
It's really just a business decision on Microsoft's part. You know, having these two organizations that were already working together are now kind of part of the same legal entity, so that they can, you know, more effectively work on those projects together instead of having to go through the paperwork of kind of contracting one group with another.
Now, the game costs $20. For $30, you can get a season pass. What does that mean?
Season pass gives you immediate access to updates and new features and things that you may otherwise pay extra for. You know, if an update comes out and you don't have a season pass, it may cost you $5 to download that season pass.
Okay.
Or to download that update. You know, so that you know, rolls out. The season pass just gives you that access. You know that you're going to keep playing the game for a while, then it's worth it to pay for that. If you think you're going to play it for 6 months and then you'll check back in a year and see what's changed, then you may only be interested in you know, paying for the updates as you go to use them.
Is the Minecraft Dungeons the sort of thing that you should have done all the other Minecraft for the last 100 years up to that point, or is it something you could jump into as a neophyte?
No, it's designed to you know, be able to just jump into play, having never played the game before.
Wow, okay. And you solo play, group play, that kind of a thing?
Yeah, so the way that the game is set up, groups are going to be something that you'll be able to do in kind of a limited fashion. It's not going to be, you know, the kind of the Fortnite style, there's 100 people in the map and you'll be able to interact with all of them. Instead, you'll have kind of local parties that you'll be able to set up with friends and play together.
Well, there's two new watch bands for the Apple Watch that we need to talk about.
It's
this is pretty
true.
Cool.
This is cool. This is something that Apple has actually done every year for the last 5 years now, and they come out right around the same time. They actually just started shipping today. Mine showed up earlier today.
Uh-huh.
This is Apple has a series of watch bands that they release every year for the celebration of Pride Month.
Yeah.
They're always kind of rainbowy in design. You know, they have a bunch of different materials that they've made them out of. Last year it was the kind of denim-y material. This year is more of the sporty material. They stand out. They're super bright colors. And this year they actually have a different sport version that works with their Nike band, which have kind of the holes all in them, and it's a little more subtle. So it's a white band that if you look into the holes in the watch, you see kind of the colors of the rainbow that go around. The two things that are kind of significant about this, one is the, you know, kind of an annual tradition that Apple has done, but two, a portion of the profits for each one of the watch bands that are sold from this collection go to a bunch of different organizations that Apple has partnered with, including PFLAG and a bunch of other organizations.
I like how the rainbow goes through the screen of the watch.
This is clever, yeah. So there's a software update to the Apple Watch that they do every year to go with the band. And when you do so, you can use that watch face to kind of integrate it all as to one kind of seamless, colorful thing. And it's cool. Unfortunately, it's not my favorite watch face. It doesn't have quite as much information. So it's a cool thing to show, but it's one of the things where I probably don't keep that watch face for super long because it's a little on the basic side. But I think other people feel a little differently. I'm a little weird with my watch faces.
Just maybe wear it to the parade or something. But, of course, they're all being canceled, so.
There's a virtual parade that's happening, but, yeah. There's going to be some weird it's definitely going to be an interesting year for that.
It's going to be an interesting year, Russell. Just speaking of Apple, by the way, have they opened the stores yet?
Apple has a list that they're producing, I think, later today that is going to have all of the stores in the U.S. that they are going to start opening and the new rules that are going to apply to those stores. And that's going to continue adding over the next couple of months as more places shift into different phases of opening. But no, as of right now, I don't think any of the Apple stores are currently open. I think that actually starts next week.
I mean, in a way, Apple may be better positioned because of the way they run their stores than a lot, where you kind of have to make appointments already if you want anything. You go in and you make an appointment, or you can call in, and it's a little bit different than most stores.
I think it would work really well if they were to stick with kind of an appointment-only model for a bit. Apple has kind of a hybrid approach when their stores are fully open, and that you have to have an appointment in order to, like, get something serviced,
yeah.
Or if you're trying to pick something up that's very specific. But you also can just kind of walk in and grab something off the shelf. And I've been in so many different Apple stores now, it's kind of hard to tell, and I'm kind of biased in that I'm usually only there when something interesting is happening. but usually those doors can get really packed,
yes,
shoulder to shoulder with people in those doors. So because of the open air design, I think appointments would be a really smart way to kind of get that going.
And they've kind of got people sort of kind of a little bit trained to do that there.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Here's a topical item, a high-tech face mask. The COVID-19 pandemic has ushered in a wave of Chinese companies doing that.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, face masks have been a significantly more prominent thing outside of the U.S. Than inside to begin with you know, other outbreaks in other places. And so there have been companies before that have kind of made higher tech face masks, but they're, you know, obviously with COVID-19, they're kind of exploding in their popularity. One of them has gotten really popular over the last couple of years for making really inexpensive fitness trackers and you know, kind of general health sleep trackers and things like that. And now the company is called Huami, and they're making these transparent face masks that can self-disinfect.
How does it do that?
It uses a combination of black light tech and you know, basically some open air filtration systems. So, you know, when you set it on its charger, which is just, you know, the concept of setting your face mask on a charger is something that's going to take me a little bit.
Yeah.
But when you do that, there's a ring of black light, ultraviolet light that will go and start the disinfecting process.
Wow. And it's called Airy, right?
This particular model is called Airy, and you know, this isn't something you're going to be able to pick up tomorrow. It's going to take them a little while. This is what we're seeing right now are prototypes. But yeah, it's a transparent face mask, which is important so that you know, people who are deaf or hard of hearing can see your lips while you're trying to communicate, which is important. But it also has a raised shield above the mask itself to protect your eyes. It doesn't, you know, completely go up and connect to the head like you see in some medical grade equipment, but mm-hmm. it gives you that kind of little extra boost of protection, which is nice.
Yeah, I like the idea that you can see. It's a kind of a plastic that you can see through, so you can see the mouth. Because, I mean, I'm kind of wondering what it's going to be like when schools reopen, and particularly with young children, what it's going to be like to try to communicate with them when, you know, a lot of us are lip reading and we don't even realize it sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I have trouble anytime I've had to talk to anybody for anything. I had someone pull over. I was going for a walk earlier this week, and they pulled over their car to ask me for directions, and I was wearing a mask, and there was just I couldn't reach them. There was no way to communicate effectively with that person. So yeah, I can only imagine, you know, and especially when you start working in communities where English is a second language and you know, other struggles like that, it's having a mask is it definitely increases the difficulty of communication in a lot of communities.
I feel like I'm always running around telling people, yeah, I'm smiling. I'm, you know, like, yeah, I can tell your cheeks make the mask go up. But so it can, I'm fascinated by this. The mask, is it like a solid type? It's not cloth, right?
No. This is a light plastic, and then there are filter systems on both sides of the mouth to help process air as it comes in and out. So you see, you know, just kind of almost where your cheeks rest, there are these pad of material that can be replaced and washed out as needed.
And they say it doesn't last forever, but they last much longer than traditional masks. And I'm trying to figure out, so the big investment then is the wherever you set it on to disinfect it?
Right, yeah. So okay. The plastic and the charger, you know, those are going to last considerably longer than a cloth mask. And then, you know, the actual ventilation parts are going to be easier to replace and kind of less expensive. And, you know, not for nothing, but they're plastic, which means people are going to decorate them.
Well, you will. It will be purple, right? You'll want a purple one.
Or like a light blue to match my glasses. I'm not okay. Super picky.
Okay. Well, maybe, or yellow to contrast. And there's a fan for breathable comfort. Where is that fan? I'm trying to visualize this.
Yeah, so in the picture, you've got these kind of two cheek materials, and they're actually built into that area.
Okay.
You know, so it's actually a powered, you know, kind of filtration system instead of a passive system like we see with most cloth masks.
Okay, gotcha. And there's a battery, I guess, somewhere involved.
Right, the battery for the fans and for the LEDs that would help with disinfecting.
Okay. You Let's talk about the YouTube Music thing. You can now transfer your Play Music library to YouTube Music. It's kind of painless, I guess, but why?
So Google is getting rid of the service that is currently called Google Play Music. This is a service that was included with Android phones for the last couple of years. It was kind of the music service that offered a streaming system. If you weren't a Spotify or a Pandora or, you know, an Apple Music subscriber, you had this kind of free on your phone. And then for, you know, if you wanted the streaming service as an added option, it was, $4 or $5 a month. Then they tried to bundle it with YouTube services. You know, doing all of this, it never really took off. It was certainly never as popular as Apple Music or Spotify. And so Google is trying to shift branding and kind of the construction of the software to a team that is actually doing well with streaming music. I mean, it's actually kind of the original streaming music service, which is YouTube, which is not a thing that a lot of people know about YouTube, is that there are tons of people who build kind of music playlists out of music videos and then just kind of have them play in the background without a video playing, well before Spotify was popular or anything like that. And for whatever reason, Google just never thought that YouTube was a good brand for music streaming. And now they've kind of pivoted a little bit. So we're seeing this YouTube music system pop up. And unfortunately, it doesn't seem like Google has learned a ton of lessons from the things that weren't super successful about Play Music. The interface is still a little on the clumsy side. You can move everything over from Play Music to YouTube Music so that you haven't lost anything. But if you have a bunch of kind of smart devices in your home that play YouTube Music, there's a limit to how many of them you can have connected, which is probably not a problem for a lot of people, but is a problem for a goofy nerd who has 6 phones and 2 tablets and, you know, just spitballing whoever that guy would be.
Whose name shall go unmentioned, yeah.
That's right. you know, so it hasn't learned a ton of lessons aside from, you know, you're already on YouTube. Why not pay an extra $2 or $3 and, you know, kind of have your music here instead of needing another app, which is fine for people who don't have another app, but it doesn't really give a compelling reason to move away from Spotify or move away from you know, Apple Music or anything like that. So it's questionable how useful this is going to be, you know, long term. But again, YouTube for a lot of people is kind of the original streaming service. So it has a chance of being a little more successful than something that's just branded to Google.
Hey, I just remembered I forgot to ask you about the Airy mask from WAMI. How much is it going to cost?
They haven't given any information on cost, but WAMI is actually really one of the things they've done incredibly well over the last couple of years is made things that are just unbelievably inexpensive. Hmm. They have fitness trackers that are $10 and $15 and sleep trackers that are incredibly inexpensive. So it's not impossible that we would see this, you know, kind of under $20 as an option.
Oh, including the charger and everything?
Yeah, that would be my guess.
Wow.
You know, that's not something that they've released publicly yet, but given some of the things that they've done in similar spaces in the past, it wouldn't surprise me.
You know, I guess we're all going to be investing in these kind of things, right?
You know, as weird as that seems, again, as a reminder, there are plenty of other places in the world that have had things like SARS breakout that have been particularly dangerous, where mask has just become part of the culture. It just became a normal thing to keep certain people safe. I wouldn't surprise me to see that be something that catches on here in a lot of communities.
And therefore starts a whole new industry in a way that the United States can either be in front of, or it's already behind the eight ball on that.
Yeah, you know, as far as being able to offer something that's you know, kind of more effective than a basic cloth mask, we're definitely not seeing a ton of American innovation here. We are seeing your favorite superhero printed on one if you buy it from the Walt Disney Company, which is hooray capitalism, I guess. But yeah, as far as a tech solution, we're not seeing a lot of development there in the U.S. yet.
Yeah, the face mask's like the new bumper sticker. I've got one that's depicts the map of the part of the Upper Peninsula.
That's perfect, yeah.
What
it's
is yours?
It's going to be like stamp collecting, only mask.
Exactly. Well, Russell Holly, thanks as always for joining us. I really appreciate your time. I hope you have a great holiday.
Thank you for having me.
That's been Russell Holly. He's contributing editor for Android Central. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.